Live,
a podcast of the cinema,
starring Alonzo Duralde. That's not me. That's the other one.
And starring Dave White, who is not me, but the other one.
You are the rap. You're the. I'm sorry.
Why don't I do this? You're the. I'm the film reviews editor of The Wrap. I'm the co-host of the Who Shot You podcast and What the Flick on the Young Turks Network.
I really, you know what I need? I need a
note card.
A note card that reminds me every week what your actual job is. Because when I try
to say it,
I just have like, bleh.
I'll tell you, something similar happens to me at What the Flick a lot of times. Even with like Ben, Matt, and Christy, who I've been doing this show with for years.
When I have to introduce them,
I'll be like, and then.
Whatever it is you do.
And I just, their names will fly out of my head.
I don't know you. We just met.
So, yeah, that's a thing that happens. Anyway, we're film critics, and we're married, and this is our program. If this is your first time, welcome.
Indeed. Welcome.
Yes.
How did you enjoy your spam?
Well, as made by you, it was delicious.
I did not make...
actual spam.
Homemade spam.
No. The, as prepared by.
Can you imagine? Oh, honey, I've made homemade spam. I've emulsified a pig. Products. An entire pig. I've just emulsified it. And I pulverized the bones into dust and included that in the emulsification.
Well, like, you know, my...
And I've turned it into a block. And now...
A gelatinous meat block.
And now we're going to enjoy its deliciousness.
My mother would never saw the point in making pizza at home. She was
there's no point.
She was like, they deliver it to you. Like,
there's no point.
Why would you make spam when it already exists to be a convenience?
Yeah. No, okay, so like...
I'm not anti-spam, though, as a general thing.
No, you're very pro-spam. You taught me to enjoy it.
Yeah.
I didn't like it. This is the difference. When you grow up, and it's a part of your house, after a while you think, as God is my witness, I'll never eat spam again. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
You become very much, you know, Mildred Pierce's daughter. You know? It's like, no, everything's greasy.
Vita.
Yeah. Thank you, Vita. Ingrate. And then I remember we met and you're like, I love to take some spam and fry it up in a pan. And I'm like, you are gross.
Well, I never had it as a child. So it
right. Was still, you had actual cooking in your house. That's why.
And B, a friend of the show, Robert Abley, introduced me to it as an adult. And I was like, this is actually pretty good. But it's all in how you do it. My doing it on its own is about slicing it really thin and frying it like bacon. Mm-hmm. But now you have made a popular online recipe into reality.
Yeah. Alvin Kylan? Anyway, the guy who runs.
The Egg Slut guy.
The Egg Slut guy. He's the guy who is the chef and the owner of Egg Slut, which is... There are two locations in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. It's an eggy breakfast sandwich shop that has lines of people waiting to be served them because they are effing delicious.
Yeah.
This video on Vice Munchies where he's talking about his favorite homemade hangover sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is the funny part. When this guy has a hangover, he's still a chef.
Yeah, he can still make sriracha mayonnaise.
Yeah. He's like, I just whip up some sriracha mayo and then I...
Julienned some scallions
and then cold shock them to make them curly. And I'm like, I thought you said you were hungover.
I was going
to
say, we're doing this completely differently.
What are you... Yeah. And anyway, it's eggs and fried spam and scallions and sriracha mayo on
four King's Hawaiian rolls.
On four unseparated King's Hawaiian rolls. Mm. Oh, y'all. I made it for lunch. Neither one of us are hungover. Neither one of us have been hungover in...
years.
Years. I guess your last hangover was closer to now than mine. But
yes.
Mine was 1991.
Yeah, okay, I've had one since then, but it's been a while.
Yeah. And so This has nothing to do with cinema. It's just something that is happening in our life right now. It's very nice. I can still taste it.
I know.
The great thing about this recipe is that it's easy.
Hmm. Even the shocking sea onions?
Listen, you don't have to do that. Like, if you want it to look pretty, mm-hmm. like some ice cold curlicue greens, like
decorating the top,
gently fluttering atop the spam and egg before you mash it down into a King's Hawaiian roll with sriracha mayo. Yeah, fine. But you could just very easily just thinly slice your green onions and
go to town.
Leave it at that. Yeah, you don't need the whole presentation. It's not important. And if you're actually hungover, I just don't understand how you would even be making these anyway.
No, you would beg someone else to make you.
You would know. You would call someone and be like, just bring me a bag of burritos, please. Just deliver them. Like, you would call a delivery place and have them bring, like, Postmates or whatever it is.
Or roll into a Lyft and, like, just take me to Denny's, please.
Yeah, something. You wouldn't do. You wouldn't stand around making this.
No.
It's easy, but you wouldn't do it.
No.
But apparently his hangovers are super working.
Yeah.
He has working hangovers.
He's a multitasker.
Like, he probably just goes into the restaurant, he's hungover, and starts cooking. Mm. You know, he doesn't care. What is the deal with all the bro chefs and how they love to tell you what big alcoholics they are?
Well, you know, after they've shown you all their tattoos.
I'm not making fun of them. I mean, I am making fun of them. I
look, the products are great. What comes out of their kitchen is beyond reproach. But
you guys,
the bro chef thing is a thing.
I love you guys. You make delicious foods for me. You have lots of tattoos, and you love to talk about drinking.
Turn down the Adam Jones, please.
I don't. No, they shouldn't have to. It's a genre of human.
All right, fine.
And it takes all kinds of humans to make the world.
Adam Jones, as no one remembers.
Now, this is where it becomes like a conversation about cinema. A film that you saw and I never saw.
Is the superstar chef played by Bradley Cooper in the Weinstein Company flop, Burnt?
Burnt.
Yes.
A film that was going to be called Adam Jones.
We saw this poster for it at the drive-in once.
I said, why is his name on the poster? I thought this name of this movie was Burnt. I mean, it was already in theaters. And they had the poster up for the old title.
Yeah.
Didn't make any sense. But that's...
They obviously had committed to that title enough to print posters and send them out.
The drive-in sometimes happens that way.
Yes.
You don't...
They don't necessarily...
They live in time. They live outside of time.
Incidentally, now would be a good time to mention, if you want to hear us talk a lot more about food or television or other topics that aren't cinema, go to our Patreon page at patreon.com/linoleumknife and subscribe.
What did I just tell you not to do before we got
You told me not to interrupt you while you talked about food, and we'd gotten to the end of that part, so I was now inserting this before we move on to the talking about movies part.
You have to stop taking every food conversation and turning it into an ad for Patreon.
No, I don't.
Yes, you do.
That's how this business works, baby. Yes,
no, because what's going to happen is people are going to be like, oh, he's talking about dinner, and then there's going to be talk about Patreon, and they're going to fast forward right there, get to the movie. So just watch your steps.
All right, I will try and keep it less predictable then.
Good.
But I'm good.
Because I'm not going to save, listen, I'm not going to save all the food chat.
And I'm not telling you to.
Or all the other life story stuff for other podcasts.
I'm not telling you to.
Even though we do other podcasts that you can subscribe to on Patreon.
Oh,
thing, those are the ads.
Okay.
Those are the ads for today. But I just, you know, like, back before we had the Patreon.
And this was just the show.
This was just the show. It was just like organically, we're going to talk about the movies. We might talk about what happened last night out somewhere else. We might talk about dinner. But...
I would never every want to digression, steal the essence of this show from the show.
Every digression does not have to turn into a self-promotion ad spot for Patreon.
Just because you ended your Instagram Chautauqua yesterday and decided to come back, I
came roaring back like a hero.
Exactly.
Is what I'm trying to tell you.
I have to do the heavy lifting of brand building.
No. I'm helping. Look at what I'm doing. I'm helping you right now.
As you wish.
Get off my back.
I live on your back.
Mm-hmm. What? Listen, movies.
Yes.
We have 5 films to discuss.
We do.
I have seen 3 of them. You have seen 5 of them.
Oh, well, yay me.
I had a big idea that I was going to go see Thoroughbreds. It looks, based on the trailer, which I have seen, looked interesting, funny, perhaps. You're telling me I don't need to bother.
It's, look, I'm not going
to
say.
Like, this is why we postponed it from last week, because I thought, I'm going to get out to the theater to see it, and I didn't have a chance, because the week was super busy.
Yeah, you didn't not see it because I told you not to see it.
No, I was very listen, I was out I was in Glendale.
Yes.
I was at the California State
Franchise
Sales Tax and Fee Administration office out in Glendale. You guys, let's say you start a business. For example, maybe you have a podcast, maybe you have 4 podcasts.
Maybe you also sell some beautiful black t-shirts with the name of that podcast across the chest in white.
Also,
still have most of the sizes available.
Also, maybe you give away free junk to people. It's not junk. You give away free prizes to people who subscribe to those podcasts. Guess what you have to do? You have to register with the state. You have to pay sales tax on every single piece of merchandise that you either sell or even just give away.
Who knew?
Who knew these things? Well, I found out the hard way. Because, listen, the other thing about starting a business?
You get to explain to people the IRS what a podcast is.
Ask someone else first who has a business how to have a business.
Yeah.
Because they might tell you things that will make you say, you know what, this sounds too hard.
Too late now.
Yeah, it's too late now. Oh my God. What a nightmare of going. Listen, filling out tax forms is terrifying. And when they're mean to you on the phone, which is what the IRS is never mean to you on the phone, but the California State Tax and Fee Assessment people are, they're not helpful or nice on the phone.
Think of how many fly-by-night California businesses they have to deal with.
I guess.
How many, like, quacks and snake oil salesmen and chakra healing crystal.
Yeah.
My booth at Venice Beach. They got to deal with all that stuff. They've had it.
Anyway, I spent a good 10 minutes trying to explain what a podcast was.
Good luck.
To the person who was helping me. And she didn't get it. She's like, well, how many of these do you have left over after the ones that you purchased in 2016? I go, No. It's not a unit of merchandise. It's digital audio content.
And
I know for a fact, based on what our accountant tells us, that we don't pay tax on the income. We don't pay sales tax on the income from that.
Ah.
The audio content it's not sales tax.
Okay.
But things, mugs, t-shirts, tote bags.
Tangible items.
Gorgeous little enamel badges.
Yeah. For instance.
You pay the sales tax on those. They have to lead you by the hand through the form. You have to go, unless you're smart enough to do it on your own at home, and I'm not. You go to the office, and someone stands next to you at the little kiosk with a barely functioning
touchscreen,
and helps you fill in the right numbers. Now, thank goodness I have all my numbers meticulously added up and separated into different categories.
Mm-hmm.
So that part I knew that I had better have that prepared before I went. But I still didn't know where what I was supposed to do with the forms. And I'm trying to explain to her. I was like, no. A podcast is not something you mail to someone. Like, you don't put it in a package and mail it to, like, it's like a radio show, but on the internet. And she's like, yes, but. I felt like I was having a nervous breakdown.
Pretend yeah. I'm NPR and that this tote bag is the Nina Toten bag.
Oh, and then after I finally got that separated and I said, okay, but here's the merch. Like, here's merch. Here's the merch that we sell and the prizes that we give away. Mm-hmm. And she goes, well, and I said, and here's the stuff that we paid sales tax on when we bought it to give it away, and here's the stuff that we did not pay sales tax on. So you got to pay sales tax on the stuff that you did not already pay sales tax on.
Right.
Also, the tax law changed 3 times in 2017. So depending on what month
right.
you purchased the things or gave them to people or sold them to people, that separates too. I go, I have no idea when that happened.
Oh, brother.
So we just went chop, 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 did the 3 different categories. Mm-hmm. Just here, plugging numbers in. It's like... like Wheel of Fortune. Is there an R behind there? Yes.
I'd like to put the rest on a service merchandise yeah. gift certificate.
And then she goes, well, how many t-shirts do you have left? I said, I have no idea. I don't know. Here's what I'll do. I'll just pay tax on all of them right now. How's that? She goes, but you'll pay more. I said, I don't care. More potholes are filled thanks to me today. You're welcome, California.
That's right.
I don't know how many I have left. There's a card table not 5 feet away from me that has stacks of t-shirts on it. That's how many I have left. Some.
this many.
We have this many left. But they're all... I paid all the tax on all of them now.
Okay.
All of it. Tax paid.
So they can fly out the door.
Yes. And then she goes, how much income did you... how much income did you make off selling t-shirts in 2017? I said, $154. She said, what? I said, $154. She said, that's not a lot. I said, we sold 7 t-shirts in the year 2017. And she goes, oh. She goes, you're very small. I said, yes.
Most of the people who want t-shirts got them with their Patreon. If, however, you would like a t-shirt, we are still selling them. Are they $22?
They're $22.
PayPal.
They're black. They say linoleum knife on them in big white letters. It's very stern looking and modern.
Yes.
You're going to be cool in
People
it.
We will be baffled by what it all means.
We have most of the sizes. Listen.
Drop us an email at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Let us know what size you want. We'll figure it out. And if you are outside the U.S., let us know that too so we can figure out how much more to charge you for postage.
Yeah. Okay, finally, movies. We're talking about the movies.
I was ready to talk about Thoroughbreds, and then you took me off on a new journey.
It was just a lot of... This is why I didn't see Thoroughbreds. Life was very stressful this week.
Everybody understands, David.
Okay.
So I wouldn't say don't see Thoroughbreds. I'm more like, it's not the end of the world if you don't, because it's not... Great. It's okay.
It's got Anya Taylor-Joy.
Yes.
From The Witch.
Yes.
In it. That was what that movie was called? The Witch?
Or The Vavitch, if you want to get technical.
The Vavitch.
Yes.
That's not what people call it.
No, The Witch.
Yeah.
And Olivia Cooke, who was the dying girl of Me and Earl fame.
Oh. Okay.
And they're both quite good.
Yeah.
Basically, Anya Taylor-Joy's character is... they're both sort of like rich, white, Connecticut, you know, daughters of wealth. Olivia Cooke...
That's a good gig.
Yeah.
If you can get it.
Yeah. Olivia Cooke's character has been out of school for a while for something having to do with a horse that isn't immediately explained, but we come to find out what exactly that's about.
Yes.
Anya Taylor-Joy is her former bestie who may or may not be hanging out with her now for the right reasons. And at some point, they try to conspire to kill Anya Taylor-Joy's terrible stepfather.
Why is he terrible?
Not for anything specific. He's just kind of a lout and a jerk. And as the film goes along...
They're going to murder him for that?
Basically.
Well, that's not very nice.
Well, as the film goes along, we get to understand the limitations of their perspective.
I mean, I'm a jerk sometimes.
No argument here.
Please don't kill me.
I won't. Okay. I promise. Anyway, it feels like it could have been a play. It's very enclosed. Like, scenes will play out entirely inside of the living room or okay. inside of the master bedroom. Like, it's, you know, it's a little claustrophobic that way. It's designed well. I get where they're trying to go for and sort of showing this kind of this bubble that these girls live in and how amoral they are.
Uh-huh.
The Olivia Cooke character basically, like, has no feelings at all. You know, she has learned how to fake it, but she doesn't have any actual feelings.
I understand that.
but it amounts to less than it's the sum of its parts, I think. It when it's over, you're kind of like, ah, okay. You know, it has a few twists along the way.
Is it funny?
It is funny at times. And whoever did the sound design, the stepfather has some bizarre piece of exercise equipment upstairs
right.
that you never see, but you hear the weird sound that it makes.
Oh.
And it just becomes this sort of like thing where it's just like it's so repetitive and constant that like you could see it driving someone crazy.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, watch it when it's on cable. I'll be curious to see what you think.
It won't lose anything in the translation to television?
No, I don't think so. Okay. It might even gain... I just, you know, here's the thing. When you tell me that this is the new Heathers.
They are really marketing the hell out of it from the Heathers angle.
Yeah. And yeah. It's like, then that's a lot to step into and it ain't that.
And that's a dog whistle for people like me.
Sure.
Because people like, people like me go, what? Ooh? Heathers? Ooh? Yeah. Yeah. And I'm instantly
intrigued.
Like, okay, well, what do you got?
Yeah. And you can tell this movie's been sitting around for a while because the late Anton Yelchin is in it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that has been on the shelf for a minute.
I think it premiered at Sundance 2017.
Okay.
So, you know, it's fine. It's just not spectacular.
Does it have a point? Does it have a reason to exist?
I mean, yeah, I suppose. It is, I mean, in a way, it's kind of like, it's sort of like White Privilege the movie, in
okay.
a way, you know.
All right.
But, you know, once you start going down the road of its twists, you pretty much can tell where it's going to wind up.
I would like there to be a distinction between white privilege and rich white privilege.
Oh, well, this
Because, I mean, I know being white, I have white privilege.
This is definitely rich white privilege.
But why can't I also have rich white privilege? Like if
because you ain't rich.
I mean, if I'm gonna have one, why can't everyone have?
Do you know what rich white privilege is? Sending somebody else to Glendale to talk to the tax people. That's what rich white people get to do.
No, you know what the rich people will hire someone who already knows how to fill out the forms.
Well, or that, yes. And then probably not pay taxes anyway.
Right. No, I brought a check. I wrote out the check. I brought a paper check with me.
Mm.
And they said...
Oh, you didn't hand them a briefcase full of cash?
Somebody should have a bag. It has a dollar sign on the bag. Here you go.
You're one of the Beagle Boys.
Yeah. I wrote out a check to him for the entire dollar amount plus all the cents.
Nice.
And then I walked out. I was like, ha-ha!
Proud to be an American!
I'm accomplished now. I know how to do things. Mostly I just know where to park at the building that's on Brand Avenue in Glendale. That's all.
You guys...
Start a business, you got some paperwork ahead of you. I'm just warning you now.
Be ready for that.
Be ready. You ain't ready, but be ready.
The other movie I saw that you did not see is also about white teenagers, but that's about the end of the resemblances.
I'm, intrigued by this, by the terribleness of this, though. You explained a bit. Okay, go on.
It's not even hilariously terrible. It's just sort of, meh. It's, okay, Midnight Sun. It is apparently based on a Japanese, either movie or miniseries, depending on what you read online.
All right.
But it is about a, Bella Thorne plays a teenage girl who has a condition known as XP. It's a real thing called xeroderma pigmentosa.
Okay, what does it do to you?
It basically means you cannot be out in the sun at all ever, even for a second. Or
not even for a second.
Like, no, it is super bad news.
What if you don't like the sun and you just would prefer to avoid it?
That's, you're just being Dave White sloth.
Okay.
No, this is a real medical condition.
All right.
So she has, you know, she lives somewhere in beautiful coastal Washington state. Her mother died when she was young. Her mm-hmm. father, Rob Riggle, has homeschooled her.
Can you go outside on a cloudy day, or is that still too much sunlight?
Nope. It's like she can go out at night. She can go out at night all she wants, but night. Not during the all daytime. Right. So, you know, he has, like, rigged up their house, so, like, the windows are dark. She sleeps during the day and is awake at night.
Yes.
You know, she has a friend, played by Quinn Shepherd, who is now an indie filmmaker, but for me will always be one of the kids from Unaccompanied Minors.
Yes.
And already I'm like, wait, if she can go out at night and she has a friend, why doesn't she have any other friends? Like, why does nobody else in her neighborhood know she exists? Why hasn't Rob Riggle tried to work out a way where she would have some sort of social life that occurred after sunset?
Play dates.
Yes.
Nighttime play dates.
Anyway, we have to go. We have to accept this as a thing that makes sense, so that we understand that she has spent her entire childhood in love with the boy down the street who's gone skateboarding past her house every day. How does she know what?
How does she know he goes skateboarding past the house every day?
Because she sees him out the window.
Oh, she's allowed to look out a window in the sunlight?
Yeah, it's a super shaded window, but she can look out the windows.
Okay.
And of course, this boy grows up to be Patrick Schwarzenegger.
Ansel Elgort.
Oh, God. Ansel Elgort is like Gary Oldman in Sid and Nancy compared to Patrick Schwarzenegger. I mean, who was it recently that I said was like a walking Lorna Doone?
Ansel Elgort, probably.
Well, Patrick Schwarzenegger in that, he's like walking library pace. Like nothing.
Is this the kid that Arnold had with the maid?
No, this is the kid with Maria.
Maria Shriver.
Yes.
That's his mom.
Yeah, so he's half Schwarzenegger, half Kennedy, all boring.
Okay.
Anyway, so on graduation night, when all the local kids have graduated from high school and she's gotten her whatever homeschool diploma, however that works, she goes out to the train station where she goes at night sometimes to play her guitar and sing the terrible songs that she was writing. And who should she run into that night but Patty Schwartz himself, to borrow from the Worst Idea of All Time podcast. Okay. Patty Schwartz, Part of Time.
Right.
Patty Schwartz, Part of Time.
Right.
Anyway, and Bella Thorne, who I have enjoyed as sort of like, you know, mean girl, bitchy characters, playing an oops, gosh, golly, awkward scene when she runs into him.
Yes.
Is one of the more painful things I have enjoyed in a movie in a while. Okay. All
right.
Anyway, the two of them fall in dull love. And she, you know, doesn't want him to think of her as only a disease, so she doesn't tell him at first. She's always like, well, I'm busy during the day, but I'm available at night.
I'm a vampiress.
Exactly. So they go on these dates, culminating in the big date where he takes her to Seattle. They see a live show. He makes her busk on the street in Seattle. And within a few notes, like, dozens of people gather around enthusiastically and start clapping along.
That's sweet, sweet music. It makes the people come together.
It is such a phony moment. Even Christy Lemire, who like gave this movie the benefit of the doubt for the most part, she was like, she goes, that scene was so awful, I couldn't stare directly at it. I had to put a pin in a shoebox to look at it. Anyway.
I could only see it at night.
Exactly. I can't remember who it was now on Twitter, but they put together the compilation of, like, sensitive boy teaches dying girl how to live.
Oh, is she dying?
Oh, yeah. Because the thing is that the disease...
You didn't tell me that part.
Yeah, she's dying. And, of course, they...
Of what?
The disease. Like,
wait a second.
Yeah. Even if you stay out of the sun, you're unlikely to live past a certain age.
Why?
I don't know.
What's the name of this disease again?
Xeroderma with an X. Xeroderma pigmentosa.
Okay, so you didn't know that we just stopped the recording, but I had to go look this up.
And?
Well, now I'm a doctor.
Ah.
And I have very important medical information for you.
Is this WebMD or Wikipedia?
Wikipedia, of course. Where else do you go to medical school?
Where the facts live. All right, so...
Fewer than 40% of individuals with the disease survive beyond the age of 20. Although it doesn't say why. This is your body can't protect itself. That's what this is really about.
Right.
And so things just... Apparently it just sort of corrodes you from the outside or something. I'm not really understanding it, but...
Anyway, she dies in that beautiful way that people die in movies when they're, you know, doomed young ladies.
Yeah.
Yeah, and again, you could argue these movies exist to sort of sacrifice women so that men can become more sensitive.
Well, that's kind of how it usually goes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Going
back to Love Story.
Exactly.
Earlier.
Yeah.
Even. Yeah.
So, yeah, this movie is just stupid. And I love a teen tragedy. I even love a teen singer-songwriter, and I didn't like any of this.
I like a teen tragedy, too.
Yeah.
What was that terrible one before? If I Stay?
I didn't see that one. I saw Before I Fall.
Before I Fall? Yeah. Before I Fall, If I Stay. Those are good.
Walk to Remember.
I mean, they're not good movies, but you know what I mean. They're like...
They're entertaining.
You totally want to watch them.
Yes.
I don't want to watch this one?
No. I
feel very disappointed.
As I have told people, this is the meter of how much of a sucker I am for... like girly singer-songwriter stuff in movies like this. I bought two of the songs off the Gem and the Hologram soundtrack. And these
That's
songs,
true, you did.
And these songs all had me rolling my eyes. So, yeah, it's... no.
Well, we both saw The Death of Stalin.
We did.
And... it's really, really, really funny.
Yes.
This is the latest film from Armando Iannucci. He is the creator of the show Veep. And also he was the filmmaker behind In the Loop.
Which was based on a show that he did in the UK called The Thick of It.
Yes. And what else has he done besides The Thick of It?
He's also one of the architects of Alan Partridge.
Was he really?
Yes.
Oh, well, see, now I did not realize that about him. Oh, look at this. He wrote a lot of I Am Alan Partridge programs.
Yes.
No wonder I love this dude. He's Scottish. And so this particular movie is right in the vein of In the Loop and Veep. It is about the death of Stalin in 1953 USSR.
And the power vacuum that created.
And the power melee it created. Now, how much of this do we think is actually based on fact? Probably some of it? Yeah.
Good chunks of it, I'm sure, yeah.
I mean, obviously Stalin died and people jockeyed for position.
Yeah. And Nikita Khrushchev came out on top.
Yeah. Is it giving anything away to say how the people in this film speak?
No, I think that's...
I mean, it is part of the joke, but it's a joke that reveals itself in the first, like, 5 minutes.
I think it's... I'm sure it's in the trailers or if you've seen clips. It's kind of inescapable. We talked about it on With the Flick.
Okay.
No one has been directed to speak in a, quote-unquote, a Russian accent.
Yeah.
There's no moose and squirrel going on here.
Yeah.
So Steve Buscemi as Nikita Khrushchev talks like Steve Buscemi. And,
right.
Jeffrey Tambor and Jason Isaacs and whoever, like, they talk like themselves.
Yeah. But they're, here's the thing about them. The differing dialects, American and all the, you know,
British,
all the variations of the dialects that you'll find in the UK. Each character kind of has a different one. And it is as though they have been cast with their, you know, original dialects in mind as an indicator of character.
Oh, totally, yeah.
Yeah.
The fact that Khrushchev is American and that, say...
And kind of a sniveler.
Right.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, you know, Khrushchev's children have more sort of upper crusty British accents because they're played by Andrea Riseborough and Rupert Friend.
Yes.
You know, then that's... Yeah, you're right. I think that's all very intentional in terms of, like, getting to understand the caste system of these people.
Yeah. And so what you have here is... totally caustic.
Yes.
Ice cold.
Ruthless comedy.
Mean comedy. Where people are bitterly cruel to each other in both word and deed.
It's like Veep, but where people are getting shot in the head.
Right. And so you'll... jokes... in this movie involve recently executed people just rolling downstairs as other characters are talking about something completely non-related to the most recent political execution that is taking place in the same building. And the interactions between the characters are every step of the way a minute, you know, power play, whether it is, you know, verbally or non-verbally.
Right. There's a constant sense of it's like, on the one hand, there's one-upmanship, but then on the other hand, there's the making sure, like, not to stray too far away from what is considered party dogma or else. Because, you know, it's the end of Stalinist Russia, and everybody's still operating under the notion that saying or doing the slightly wrong thing will have you dragged off and shot in the middle of the night.
My favorite person. Simon Russell Beale is a name that I did not really know for now. He's been in a lot of stuff. And he's been in a lot of stuff that I've seen. However.
He's a British that guy.
He's a character actor whose face you will recognize only after he makes himself memorable to you in one role or another. Otherwise, he, you know, comes in and is just part of the scenery.
Right.
And, like, he was in Into the Woods. He was in The Deep Blue Sea. He's been in a lot of television.
Was he the husband in Deep Blue Sea?
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
That's the Deep Blue Sea with Rachel Weisz.
Not the shark movie. We're talking about
the
Terrence Davies
movie.
Anyway, in this film, he plays Lavrenti Beria, and I don't really know who that person was.
He was the head of the secret police. What would the, I think it's the NKVD, what would later be the KGB.
Yeah. And his facial expressions and the way he rolls his eyes and the looks of chagrin and the looks of panic on his face, he becomes the most watchable person.
Oh, yeah. No,
in the movie.
He's a scene stealer. For sure. And Rupert Friend cracked me up.
Like, yeah.
After, you know, after seeing him on Homeland for several seasons, go through a whole whirligig of emotions and whatnot.
Yeah.
Like, he's such a twit and such
an idiot.
Such an, an entitled moron. The first scene where we meet him and he's like coaching the Russian hockey team by yelling at them, play better. It was a howling.
Jason Isaacs is also
so good.
So forceful and so, angrily hilarious. Just this barking dog that people are terrified of.
And Jeffrey Tambor is perfect for, like, the kind of person that you know is not going to last very long. in a position of power because right. he's just such a weasel.
Here's how good this movie is. It made me forget all about the current Jeffrey Tambor stuff. When it was over, I was like, oh, wait, Jeffrey Tambor. Oh, you made this before your current
troubles.
But I wasn't even thinking about it.
No,
because the film is so... it engulfs you in its, you know, world.
Yeah.
And it does not let you forget where you are.
And you know, it does that thing where, like, when characters are introduced with a little, like, lower third, basically telling you their name and their position, and sometimes it matters and sometimes it just
kind of blur
together. But it's effective, and it's a movie that it earns the right to do that.
When I walked out of it at the end, I saw it with friend and neighbor Gary Cotty. And he looked at me and goes, well, that was a smarty pants comedy, wasn't it? I said, yeah. Yeah. It was. Thank God. How many of those do you get? Ever.
Right.
One or two a year, if you're lucky. So, you know, if this guy could just pop them out a little faster, we could be guaranteed, you know.
This played
one every other year
this,
or so.
This played the UK, I think, last year.
Yeah. Yeah, why it took so long to, you know, open in the United States, I don't know, but...
Go see it.
Yeah, last October it opened in the UK and Ireland and across Europe.
Well, I hope that doesn't mess up its, you know, award campaign later. Like, you know, last year when I was really gunning for Their Finest, it was a 2016 movie in the UK, and the US distributor didn't even send screeners of it to, like, critics or voting members.
I don't know what that will mean.
I don't know.
For that, it might not mean it might be a disqualification situation.
Yeah, well, because that's one of my favorite screenplays of this year so far. No
question. Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's a very topically relevant as well.
Oh yeah,
because if you ever had any question in your head about what most politicians, what people in high-ranking positions of power are about, they're not about you.
They're about keeping their power.
They're about keeping
building it.
They're about keeping their power, destroying someone else's power, taking that power for themselves.
Yeah, getting more.
So this is a comedy about wicked, wicked, evil, grasping people.
Yes.
And it's hilarious.
It is.
Yeah. Okay, so we also watched Pacific Rim.
Uprising.
Something, whatever the sequel name is.
Uprising.
I have not been more bored in quite a while.
Really?
Yeah, why don't you tell people what the hell happens in this tedious, unsurprising, unfun movie?
Okay, so it's like 10 years, 20 years? Time has elapsed since the
some
first
time movie. Has gone by.
Yes. John Boyega plays the son of Idris Elba's character, whose name was, lest we forget, Stacker Pentecost.
That's a good name.
Stacker Pentecost meets Flipper Purify.
Yeah.
Anyway, he's not out to be a hero. He runs around like selling parts from old discarded robots. And meets this girl who has built her own sort of mini robot that she can run herself, because usually in the world of this movie, it takes two people to run one.
Kaylee Spaney.
Yeah.
She's kind of newish.
Yeah, and she's like 19, but plays a character who acts...
I'm sorry, she's how old?
She's 19. The character...
No.
Yeah, you would think she was like 14 or something.
I thought she was 10. I'm not kidding. I thought it was like a 10-year-old child.
No. She's a woman. So they both get apprehended and dragged off to Ranger School, where he becomes an instructor because he had already been there, and she becomes a new recruit. He is reunited with his old best pal and rival, played by Scott Eastwood, who, I have to say, as terrible as he is a better actor than Patrick Schwarzenegger as far as, like, Sons of, even though most of Scott Eastwood's bag of tricks seems to be trying to replicate his father's sort of squint and gravelly, you know.
I'm sorry. I just can't get over this. I just went and looked her up. She turns 21 this year.
Oh, wow.
She's 20 right now. Kaylee Spaney, however you say her last name.
Yeah, she's like the plucky girl in this movie.
Maybe she looks 12. I said 10, but maybe she looks 12.
I don't know what to tell you.
How is that possible?
Look, they give her a love interest, so like she had to be
not
a little
really.
Kind of, doesn't she?
With the, not the, really.
Anyway, so basically, after the last movie, the robots stopped the kaiju and sealed off the dimensional rift where they came in.
Right.
Now there's this company that wants to replace the manned Jaegers with drones that would do the same thing. But, of course, it turns out there's something hinky going on with the drones. And I will say this, as dopey as the movie is, the plot actually makes sense and has some fun in it and has some surprises. So I won't talk too much about that.
It does make sense.
Suffice it to say, of course, it's monsters v. robots all over again.
Yeah.
Missing this time around is Guillermo del Toro directing, which, you know, is a bummer. But I will say this, the first Pacific Rim, and I watched it on the Warner lot. It's not like I went to a crappy theater to see it. I watched it in 3D on the Warner lot.
Yep.
And I could not make out what was going on most of that movie because the 3D was dark and almost all the robot monster fights were taking place either
at night or in the rain, or both.
No, at night, in the rain, both, or at the bottom of the sea.
Right.
Yeah. So this movie, just by virtue of it being outdoors and under the sunshine...
Daylight, yes.
...made it a much more pleasurable viewing experience. And while, you know, people are saying, oh, well, then it's just a Transformers movie, but it's so much more visually coherent than anything Michael Bay has ever made, there's that. So the Monsters v. Robots parts, I thought were really fun and delivered what you would want in a Monsters v. Robots movie. Unfortunately, when they're not fighting, you have to listen to the people talk and they're all boring.
The people are boring. There is no on-screen chemistry between any of the actors.
Not really, no.
I like John Boyega. I like him. I wish this... were a better showcase.
Oh, I know.
For him.
All I could think of while watching this was like, I would rather be watching Attack the Block.
Yes. Yes. There are literally three monsters in this movie. You wait 75% of the film to see them. But you get the robots constantly from start to finish. You get the robots. And thanks to Transformers Burnout, a movie that's primarily dominated by giant robots.
Don't care.
Don't care. The fights are visually more coherent than anything that's ever been in a Transformers movie. But nothing popped. Nothing was fresh. Nothing was interesting. Nothing was surprising. This is... absolutely rote filmmaking. And technically, it's, you know, a fun cartoon. It's all CGI, everything.
Yeah.
And,
well, I was talking
so, about- you know, I can't crap on it, crap on it as a technical achievement because, you know, people work really hard on this stuff and, yes. And they make it look, gleaming and shiny and nice, but there's nothing there.
I was talking about this on What the Flick. That, you know, these are the kind of movies that used to be like drive-in fare. You know, monsters, car races,
yep.
Superheroes,
yep.
You know, science fiction, outer space stuff.
Yeah.
Somewhere along the line, that became the A-list property.
Yes.
And what studio movies do are not only to throw more money at that kind of thing, but also give you like real actors and a script that takes these characters sort of seriously and gives you a context in which they would exist.
Yes.
And this movie just feels like it's a dumb, like 1950s robot monster movie with a budget and with some actors you recognize.
Right.
Which, so, I mean, I'm not saying it's any better than that, but that's an okay thing to be. I mean, it's not, I didn't think it was aggressively terrible. It's just kind of whatever, but I did at least enjoy the spectacle of the big, you know, stuff they're trying to do.
It's a spectacle that other films have done over and over again.
I guess it ain't special. I mean, I'm not trying to argue that it is, but I was entertained by the spectacle parts.
You know, there's a very, you know, there's a lot of Chinese elements in the film as well, mm-hmm. that are designed to make it play. You know,
well, yeah,
there.
Apparently the only reason this movie exists is because it was a huge hit in Asia, much more than it was in the United States.
Yeah. So you've got Tian Jing.
Right.
I'm sure I'm killing her name, unfortunately. But, you know, she's a big star.
Yeah.
So, and she has a significant role in the film.
Yes.
As someone who yells instructions.
Yes.
Seriously, that's what, well, that's what she does.
And there's a running gag about, like, white people who can't speak Mandarin.
Yeah, and those were the funny lines
yeah.
in the movie, because you know, you've got Charlie Day trying to speak Mandarin. Mm. And if I were an audience member in China, I would laugh at that. I laughed at it here.
Yeah, and the movie promises the exact same sequel. The ending promises the exact same sequel that the Independence Day sequel promised, except that nobody saw the Independence Day sequel, so we're never going to get that movie. But this one we might.
Thank God we're never going to get that movie.
Yeah, that second one was dreadful.
I don't need to get the sequel to this one.
I don't either.
I enjoyed the first one, in spite of the fact that the monsters and the robots fought in the dark and the rain and under the water. It didn't bother me. This one lacks the Del Toro sense of playfulness.
I guess I'm hot and cold with Del Toro. I loved Shape of Water, but I was just kind of on the first Pacific Rim, and I'm on this one, but for different reasons. But I think at least on the level of show me monsters fighting robots, I feel like I got a better deal out of that with Uprising than I did with the first one.
So there's a new Wes Anderson film in town.
Mm-hmm.
Its name is I Love Dogs.
Yes. But Isle of
Isle.
Dogs.
Isle, as in Island of Dogs.
Yes.
But, you know, if you say it, I Love Dogs, that's the other title.
Yes.
And that's intentional.
Indeed.
This film is set, it's stop motion animation.
Mm-hmm.
It's set in Japan.
Yes.
It follows a pack of diseased dogs. They all have a doggy disease, and they have been banished from Japan to a trash island.
Yes.
Off the coast of Japan, where they are meant to die out and there will be no more dogs. And the government has whipped up anti-dog hysteria,
mm-hmm.
and turned the population against their own pets. So everyone puts their pets in the little boxes and sends them off to the trash island because they are afraid that the pets are going to kill them with their disease, their doggy disease. There is one little boy, a Japanese boy, who pilots his own plane to the trash island to rescue his dog. Instead, he meets the other
roving pack,
and they've never heard of his dog, and they are trying to find him with the boy who is referred to as Little Pilot by
yes.
the dogs. His name is Atari. The dogs are voiced by Brian Cranston and Edward Norton and Bob Balaban and Bill Murray and Jeff Goldblum. Jeff Goldblum is is the best.
Yes.
There is a female dog, Scarlett Johansson, voices.
There is an American exchange student
who's voiced by Greta Gerwig,
who rallies her classmates to come to the support of Atari to rescue the dogs.
Because she senses a conspiracy against
yes.
the dogs and wants to overthrow the mayor of the town.
Yes. Megasaki.
Megasaki, fictional town.
Yeah, it's set like 20 years in the future.
Yeah. So, what exists here is a couple of different things. A stop-motion animated film from Wes Anderson in the, you know, style of Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Yes. And there's something about the way he shows dogs' faces that sort of fits in the deadpan mode of Wes Anderson acting.
Yes. Yes. Which is a beautiful achievement. If you are a fan of Wes Anderson and the acting style that he prefers from his human actors, it somehow manages to get that same quality from animated dogs.
Yes.
And it's not just the voice actors, it's the look of the dogs themselves. Right. Yeah.
But the dogs are all voiced by American and British actors speaking English.
And the human beings in the film,
except for Greta Gerwig
and Frances McDormand as a translator. All the human beings in the movie are Japanese, and they speak in Japanese, and it is unsubtitled.
Right.
So that you are meant to identify with the plight of the dogs rather than anything that a human being might say. Unless
you speak Japanese.
Unless you speak Japanese, or unless you are, you know, obviously the Greta Gerwig character or the Frances McDormand character. So, before we get into the difficult stuff here, as an animated achievement, it's beautiful.
Yes.
And it looks like a Wes Anderson movie. It looks like all the Wes Anderson movies, both animated and live action.
It is meticulous and crammed with detail.
And not just the fact that Fantastic Mr. Fox was like for kids. There is and there always has been, maybe not going back to Bottle Rocket so much, but from Rushmore on.
Mm-hmm. If you're going to say melancholy, then yes, Bottle Rocket too.
No, not melancholy.
Okay.
There's a sort of, and this is not something I've invented. This is, critics say this constantly. People who write about and talk about Wes Anderson films talk about this all the time. The diorama quality,
right.
The storybook quality, mm-hmm. of his narratives, the sort of hermetically sealed world,
yeah.
where you recognize it as this amalgam of past and present. Stylistically, the design elements are always from like the 60s.
It's the Richard Scarry version of the world.
Yeah, it is. They are their own little universes.
Yeah.
And you could imagine that they all are the same universe. Like these stories could all be happening in different parts.
The
Wes Anderson, you know, cinematic universe. Yes. And so, because of that, I think there is, on the part of Wes Anderson, there's a certain feeling of license to go where he feels like going and to tell the story he feels like telling, no matter where it happens to be set, no matter what other culture it might be besides his own. Mm-hmm. And his own culture is that of, you know, bohemian aristocratic American. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I was thinking white guy with taste, but, you know, that's...
Right, yes, but more specific than that, a very, very sort of old-fashioned, preppy bohemian...
Yes.
We've got money. We've traveled the world. We've been educated. We're having sophisticated conversations, even if we are 9.
Yes.
And also, even if we aren't those things, we are being written by a person who is those things, and that makes sense in this world.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's also something very specific about his love of outdated technology.
Right.
That reminds me of sort of growing up in the 70s and seeing like people would have, like people bought reel-to-reel players when they were having a moment, you know, and then sort of let them get dusty or old, like just old things like that.
Yes.
You know, I think later generations wouldn't know that because that stuff just got shipped out to recycling and nothing gets old anymore because you don't fix it. You just replace it with a new thing. So there's something about the specifics about the old technology
your childhood home.
Yes.
The one that I have visited.
Mm-hmm.
The physical building. Your childhood home, before it was sold and people left and moved out, is the closest thing I have ever been to being in the house where the Royal Tenenbaums live. Like... And so that house is not uncommon in the world of Wes Anderson types.
Sure. Guilty.
But yeah, that's the design element.
Okay.
But here's the problem. Here are some problems. It feels like in this movie that Japan is a design element.
Thank you. Yes,
that's the thing. And I don't know why, other than Orientalism, which Wes Anderson is an educated person and knows that this is a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
It has been a real thing for 200 years.
Yes.
He knows this. And I think that by surrounding himself with Japanese collaborators, people who collaborated on this project with him.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the name? Kunichi Nomura, who's got a story credit.
Yes, he co-wrote the film, and he is also the...
Well, Wes Anderson wrote the screenplay.
Okay, he has a story credit on the film, and he voices the mayor.
Yes.
Yoko Ono is in this film.
Jun Takahashi has a very brief cameo as a voice, you know, in the film. If you don't know who Jun Takahashi is, it's significant in the world of Wes Anderson because he is an avant-garde fashion designer from Japan. The label is Undercover. Wes Anderson has never been far away from that part of the creative world.
Right.
You know, like The Imitation of Christ, Tara...
Yes.
I'm blanking on her name. Anyway, So, you know, he's got people who are working with him who are Japanese who clearly don't think that, you know, this product is
a violation
or cultural appropriation or racist or, you know, anything.
Cultural tourism.
Or even cultural tourism, which you might, you know, be able to apply to a film like Darjeeling Limited.
Right.
Although
that movie at least had three central American characters.
It's about Americans in another place rather than
the place
itself. I'm going to tell a story about the people who live here as though I know.
Right.
This movie
could be
Kunichi Nomura's participation in this film, and I've read an interview with him where he said, "Oh yeah, Wes Anderson came to me and said, help me make this right. Help me make sure that this is being done properly." And so he's like, okay, yeah, sure, that'll be my job.
But this movie could be set in Galveston.
It could, yes. There's
nothing innately Japanese about it. It's mainly about these dogs that have been, you know, exiled.
Does that mean that he is being an appropriator versus an appreciator? Does that mean that that this is racism? Now, here's what I cannot speak to. This, because I'm not Japanese and I'm not Asian, and it's not for me to say.
No, I agree. I think
what's going on here is right or wrong.
Go read what Justin Chang has to say about it, and Jen Yamato and Andrew Kang. A lot of
three people who are friends of ours who have been guests on this show,
yes,
and who are part of the extended Linoleum Knife universe. Thank you very much. They've got interesting stuff to say about this movie, and I don't think they're wrong.
No. And here's the other thing. Even if we are to, if we table this entire discussion,
yeah,
which we should because we're two white guys and it's, you know, I don't know that there's only so far, only so deep we can get into this, I still have problems with this movie. I still found it...
It's the least emotionally involving for me, and it should be the most because it's about doggies.
Exactly. Exactly. I put this down with Darjeeling Limited, not just because of the Orientalism, but because of the... I didn't care.
Right.
I was not engaged in the story, and that was a big problem for me because Fantastic Mr. Fox is my favorite Wes Anderson movie.
It's magnificent.
I adore that film, and I want him to make more animated films.
Yeah.
And this one just kind of left me cold. And so then the whole, like, why are you making this movie about Japan, white guy, is just a whole other thing that's an issue. But even if we take that issue out, I still don't love this movie.
There is so much loving reference to any number of Akira Kurosawa films.
Oh, yes.
Here. And so here's the thing. I think Mr. Anderson's
Heart
is in the right place. I think this is a film made in good faith. Mm-hmm. I just don't know if it was the smartest move to do it the way he did it.
Yeah.
And if I'm going to shut up and listen to Jen and Ingu and Justin, then I have to just say, my verdict is, I don't know. I don't know. All I know is that this is a beautiful looking movie that was made with good intentions and still somehow may not be right.
And it lacks the soul of films like Grand Budapest Hotel and Moonrise Kingdom and Rushmore.
And I'm not even trying to tread delicately here. I'm saying straight up, I don't know the answer.
No, agreed.
I point you to Jen, Justin, and Ingu.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And there's also an article written by, I forget the person's name, Atlantic, I think, The Atlantic. But if you go to Jen Yamato's Twitter and Ingu's Twitter,
they're linking to stuff.
They link to everything. And here's another thing. Ingu wrote a tweet where she said that a lot of the conversations that she's been having have only been with other Asian film critics and other Asian writers, mm-hmm. because to have those conversations in public on Twitter makes white people furious and come after them. And I'm like, okay, well then we have an even bigger problem.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And I totally believe that because...
Of course.
No, I mean, A, because she said it, but B, I happened to look at the comments on the What the Flick review of this movie, where we mention that this is an issue that exists that people are talking about, but I tried to sort of like do the same thing here, like you should go hear what those people have to say about it.
Yeah,
all the comments like, how dare you,
blah, how dare you,
blah,
yeah,
blah, 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 blah. And oh, here's, you'll love this one, false equivalency of the week.
What about
why is it okay for Death of Stalin not to have Russian people in it, but then Isle of Dogs has to be all Japan, blah, 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 blah. Seriously,
it's not the same thing.
That was an actual complaint made by several knuckle dragging goons over at What the Flick. So yeah, just a reminder of me, never ever ever look at the comments.
I am going to not know until I get, you know, all the other voices that need to be heard about this one. The end.
Yeah, that's all there is to say right now.
What you said. Even if this weren't a troubling aspect of the film, it would be a lesser entry in the Wes Anderson world.
I agree. Yeah, even if this were set in Galveston, I would still be kind of. Eh. What's your DVD pick?
Black Narcissus.
Tell the people.
We got to go to see a nitrate print of Black Narcissus. Now, Black Narcissus is a 1947 film from Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger. The Archers!
That's right.
It is about a group of nuns who are sent to a former seraglio in the Himalayas and meant to open up a hospital and a school. And they kind of barge on in.
Yeah. Well, they were invited.
By whom?
By the Sultan or whoever, the general.
Oh, yeah, you're right. The Sultan did bring them in. But they still don't know what they're doing.
No, no. They're
all British. That part. I forgot that part. The Sultan did summon them, yes. They're all British. They don't speak the language. and they are beset by emotions and feelings and trouble with the weather.
The wind, the damn wind.
The wind and the clean air bother them.
Yes.
And the other thing that bothers them is a...
dude in shorts.
A guy who wears shorts and sometimes no shirt. And he makes them all go a little wild. It's a psychological drama about sex.
Yes, and repression.
In a world where no one can talk about sex.
Right.
It is also a very strangely modern film for a variety of reasons, in that it gets that the missionary narrative is
a colonizing one,
and that the resistance that they get from the people is their own fault. And so when they, the nuns, say blatantly racist things throughout the film, the film doesn't appear to be signing off on this.
No.
It is a film where the more they say and the more they do, the more you think, y'all just should go home.
You are out of your
element. Just get out. Just go. You had not even be there. Yeah. You know, the fact that their geographic location used to be a home for the harem,
yes,
sort of works its sexy spell over them.
Well, there's all these sort of like somewhat lewd tapestries.
Yeah, yeah, they want them all taken down and everything. And from a technical standpoint, this film is
one of the most beautiful Technicolor films ever made.
It's just glorious to behold. Your eyes are... You could turn the volume down.
The great Jack Cardiff.
And just watch. They use a lot of... They use scenes from this film a lot in the cinematography documentary. Visions of Light. And that's where I first became aware of its existence. Long time ago.
But this was an actual 1947 release print that the Academy had in their archives.
Yeah.
And nitrate prints are hard to come by these days. They are super volatile. They stopped making them in the early 1950s. If you remember the big fire in Cinema Paradiso, that's what nitrate prints would do. They would catch fire if you weren't careful. And to screen them now, you have to have a special booth that, you know, and projectors and stuff, so that, you know, if anything happens, like, it's not going to catch fire, basically. And the Egyptian recently redid their whole booth because the TCM Festival does screenings there, and they do other stuff throughout the year. And so they've been showing some nitrate prints lately to kind of, you know, break in the new equipment. And so, yeah, this was this Archival Academy print. It was just beautiful. And there's a lovely Criterion Blu-ray.
The costumes are perfect. These nun outfits are the heaviest, most alien looking.
Yeah. Things. Like they're constantly in shade, their heads, you know.
And Kathleen Byron.
Oh, man.
As the wild Sister Ruth, who is probably the most sexually tormented of the of the people in this film. Watching her face is one of the great pleasures of cinema. And watching her apply lipstick.
Yeah. And Deborah Carr, one of her great roles, too.
When she puts on lipstick, you think, oh, no. It's going down.
Everybody back up. It's about to get real here.
So, even if you're watching it at home on a Blu-ray or a DVD, watch it. Because it's one of the greatest films ever made.
It is.
And you should see it.
No question. Well, my pick this week is the Alan Partridge movie that came out a few years ago, 2013. If you have never seen Steve Coogan's Alan Partridge on TV in one of the many series that he did in the UK, this is a good primer. It's a good place to start. And this one is actually co-written by Armando Iannucci, who did Death of Stalin. and it involves Alan in the middle of a hostage situation at the radio station where he works, and of course, in his inimitable Alan Partridge style, making everything much worse and more complicated than it needs to be. It's very funny, and if you know the show, if you love the show, then there's a lot of fun stuff in there. But if this is your first encounter with Alan Partridge, you will know why people love Alan Partridge. It's a lot of fun, so check it out.
Letters. Samantha.
Mumba?
Samantha Mumba is writing in. Yes.
Oh, good.
Yes. She got to tell you this. that's a stupid joke. Okay. Yeah. Dear David Alonso, you may remember me from last year as being the girl who cried at La La Land.
Of course we do.
Yes, we do. And so I decided to write again a year later to update you on my hysterics and let you know, once again, how much I enjoy your podcast, among other things. If you don't remember me, that's okay too. Since viewing La La Land multiple times and weeping through all of them, my greatest achievement in the world of film has been to watch Richard Linklater's Boyhood 4 times.
Woo!
And to declare electronic media and film studies as my minor, which is awesome, except for the fact that I have to watch movies with colossally dumb people. Guess what?
That's not going to change.
That's never going to go away. No matter what you do in life, no matter where you go, no matter where you think you're watching a film, there's going to be some jerk in the audience with you who will try to ruin it for you by being dumb. That will happen everywhere you go.
Even at a professional critic screening.
Even there. Often there. In fact, routinely there. Half of the people in my classes are really well-read and interested in film, and the other half are these really exceptionally boneheaded racist frat guys whose favorite movie of all time is, and I am not kidding, Batman versus Superman. Oh. Sometimes I wish my wonderful professors and I could talk about Fruitvale Station without having to explain to Chad from Alpha Alpha Macho Phi that the answer to police brutality isn't for black people to be more careful. Seriously, it's always a beautiful day to be racist here in the cloudy Midwest. Anyway, I thought I would ask about a problem I have confronted a lot recently, and that is whether or not it is wise to censor for ourselves what movies we watch. Hmm. I know Dave has said many times to, all caps, watch all the movies, so that we can learn about what we like, what we don't like, and what works and doesn't work. This is a mantra I totally agreed with until I was extremely upset by several films. I'm not talking like I cried at La La Land. Either. For example, when I watched the Coen brothers' A Serious Man and Darren Aronofsky's Black Swan, I was very disturbed in ways I wasn't expecting, with side effects such as anxiety attacks, upset stomachs, trouble sleeping, etc. If it seems like I might be overly sensitive, I might point out that I was raised and still thrive in a very Catholic household where I literally didn't discover the internet until I was about 14. And I've spent the past 3 or 4 years playing catch-up. I was sheltered for a long time, then broke very free of that very fast, only to become increasingly unsure whether some boundaries are good. However, I'd also like to say I'm not a total wimp because I freaking love The Babadook, Get Out, and comedies, black comedies like Force Majeure. As people who watch movies constantly, I was wondering if you had any insight into this, if any movies that really rattled or upset you, or whether you think putting some movies off as totally off-limits is a good idea. You can tell me I'm being an overly sensitive teenager whose hormones will chill out eventually. Sorry, this is hella long. Best wishes, Sam. P.S. Please find some way to contact Tiffany Haddish and get her on this podcast. That is the content the world needs, and she is such an angel. I know she would do it if she had the time. You know what? From your mouth to Tiffany Haddish's ear, yeah. Because we adore her. And if she ever wanted to come over to this house, I would bake her a cake and she could take it all home with her if she wanted.
You would make her those breakfast sandwiches.
I would make her those breakfast sandwiches, whatever it took.
Yeah. Interesting question. I think that... unfortunately, as a young person or a relatively young person, you're kind of still in the stage of having to see things to figure out what are and are not beyond the pale.
Right.
You know, I for example, if you were to tell me, oh, I liked, you know, The Babadook and Force Majeure, am I going to be able to handle a serious man? I'd say, oh, well,
of course,
sure.
Yeah.
You know, but obviously everybody is individual and that kind of thing. You know, like, for example, I will never see any of the Human Centipede movies. Don't want to, don't need to, just don't feel like it's my jam at all. Not my thing. So I'm not gonna. So yeah, I totally self-edit all the time. I mean, you should see as many different kinds of films as you can. But ultimately, yeah, once you really understand your own tastes and your own limits, it's totally fine to rule out certain films sight unseen.
This is a very difficult question.
Yeah.
Because it does butt up against the idea of having small C Catholic tastes.
Right.
And also, it does make knowing yourself very important. Unfortunately, knowing yourself only comes with time.
True.
And experience.
Yes.
And so to have a traumatic experience during watching a film
is in itself a learning moment.
Is something you won't know
unless you have
until you go and have it.
Yeah.
I can't. I'll tell you. I know what it is. I know the one.
Okay.
This is such an obscure movie. And I think I've actually talked about this before, probably on a podcast of this very show, probably a few years back.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Belgian film from the late 80s. It goes under various titles. It is sometimes known as Crazy Love.
Oh, Love is a Dog from Hell.
And it is sometimes known as Love is a Dog from Hell.
Dominique de Roder, based on the writings of Charles Bukowski.
I saw it when it was released. I was 23, 24.
Mm-hmm.
I was a young man. Backstory. When I was 15 years old, my face decided to explode in dermatology textbook case acne. And I don't just mean some pimples. I mean a brutal excavation of my face, requiring the services of multiple dermatologists and years of medication. Finally, the experimental drug at the time, Accutane, came along, and it took me 2 rounds of Accutane to calm it down. I kept having acne until I was well into my 30s. But between the ages of 15 and 25, it was almost unmanageable. Like, in a way that was physically painful and psychologically difficult. Because you look in the mirror with that happening to your face, and you go, nope. Nope, not going outside. Not today. Or you literally have strangers coming up to you telling you how to fix it. Or asking you what's wrong with you. Like, seriously, it's a bitch. So, here's this movie. And it's about a kid who, as a teenager, has such horrific acne that he goes to his school dance with a paper bag over his head.
No,
not a paper bag over his head. Wrapped in toilet paper.
Yeah, like a mummy.
Paper bag, his head wrapped in toilet paper, to blot the seeping lesions. Okay. Which, by the way, a real thing. I never wrapped my head entirely in toilet paper, but I always had some on me in case something just broke on my face without my help. Just would do it. That would just happen. Now, today I'm 53 and I have a beautifully handsome scarred face. Oh, I'm so sexy. But it took a long time to get to that. But the this movie, the kid in the movie grows up to be like a miserable person. and who then has sex with a corpse and then commits suicide by walking into the ocean. The end. Thanks, Bukowski. And when I walked out of that movie, I thought, okay. I'm not a petty criminal yet. I haven't had sex with a corpse yet. I can't imagine walking into the ocean to kill myself or killing myself ever. Cling to life desperately as I do. But it really, it turned my head around for a couple weeks. I just thought, is there actual hope, like, in the world for a person who can't look at themselves in the mirror without seeing, like, a monster face? You know, I joke now about having a monster face. But I don't think I do. But back then, if you had asked me, I'd be like, oh, yeah. I'm unlookatable. Like, it was, that was not a good time. So, but how was I to know that going in to that movie?
Right.
I didn't know. I had not read those stories, the three stories that the film is based on. And how, but other than seeing that film, how am I to know that I'm going to be so psychologically under-distanced from it that I can't even look at it objectively as a movie? It is pushing all of my buttons so hard. Films about films about childhood chaos will do that to me as well. The Florida Project just was devastating to me. But, you know, I'm grown, and so it's okay now. Like, I'm 53, and it's, I can see The Florida Project and see it as a film rather than, a child in peril, a child in danger, you know.
Look, I've told the story on this show before about when we went to see Summer Hours.
Summer Hours, Crooklyn.
Yeah.
Any mom dying movie you have a hard time with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know what the answer here is. I mean, like, I don't regret having seen those films.
Right.
But I do know that they were upsetting when yeah. I saw them. And sometimes, you know, I guess art gets to do that. I don't know what the answer here is. You know.
We get into the subject of trigger warnings with this kind of thing because sometimes there is content in a film that is so difficult.
Yeah.
That you don't know who out there is going to be traumatized by it.
Right.
Who's going to feel like the sting of that subject matter.
Yeah.
It's a tough one. You know, unless we have warnings on everything, you're just going to walk into stuff cold and not know if it's going to hurt you inside for a while.
Yeah. But, you know, sometimes in the long view of it is it may be immediately upsetting or distressing or anxiety provoking, but in the long run, you know, it's a thing that you maybe confronted that you didn't know that you needed to confront, or it's a thing that if you see it again in another movie, you're less likely to be upset by it because you've had that first experience of seeing it or thinking about it or, you know, experiencing that thing, and that sort of helps you, you know, create a callus against things that might really, you know, mess you up. I don't know. There's no easy answer and there's no wrong answer. If you feel that you need to sort of self-edit, you know, then that's a totally viable way to do it. Or if you decide that you just are going to dive in and take a shot, then that's valid too.
Yeah. That probably did not answer your question at all.
Sorry about that. What do you want from us?
Stephen Hart has two things to say about the 1517 to Paris.
Movie I can barely remember seeing, and I know we did.
I just went to 1517 to Paris because Black Panther was sold out.
Oh.
I wonder if the reason Clint Eastwood used the actual people as actors was so that he could then fold in the pre-existing footage of them receiving medals from the French president and have it be consistent.
That seems like the long way around. Like, I think you could have Forrest Gumped some actors into that footage
right.
with more ease. I think he was going for something else. I think he was trying to, make the fact that these were the real guys give the movie some sort of dramatic heft that, you know, the gelato purchasing did not.
Riveting.
Yes.
No one will be seated during the the intense gelato eating scene. Second, he says, another question. Why does one of the kids have two single beds in his bedroom?
For
sleepovers?
I don't know.
Listen, if you had asked me 10 years ago, why does Clint Eastwood do the things he does? I might be able to say, well, you know, I have a theory. I have an idea, because all I ever thought about 10 years ago was Clint Eastwood as a filmmaker whose films I generally liked. Mm-hmm. But lately...
Well, now we have Scott Eastwood, who is half Clint and half the chair he argued with.
Yeah, can we talk about Scott Eastwood in Pacific Rim?
Sure. He does the squint and he tries to talk like that.
For Christmas, you got me a beautiful cake stand.
Mm-hmm.
Its top is made of corian, and its base is this beautifully turned, carved walnut base. It is more expressive than Scott Eastwood. The walnut base of my cake stand is more expressive than Scott Eastwood.
And Scott Eastwood is more expressive than Patrick Schwarzenegger.
I remember that movie that Scott Eastwood was in where he was like the rodeo guy whatever.
The longest ride. Where they inherit the art
collection. They inherit the art collection, and he looks straight up at a Cy Twombly and says it's BS.
Uh-huh. And you wanted to punch him.
And in my head now that I've seen Pacific Rim and other things with Scott Eastwood, I think, did you ad-lib that line about Cy Twombly? Because it would scan to me if you did. Like, I like to give actors the benefit of the doubt.
Uh-huh.
I don't actually put them on a scorecard in my head and think, you better earn it. You've got some earning it to do. But I'll tell you, Scott Eastwood has some earning it to do. That dude is very attractive.
Yes. And that's kind of it.
Oh, are we going to keep talking about him? Because that's all there is to say.
Ay, ay, ay. Are we done?
I was done 3 minutes ago.
Okay, fine, Cy Twombly. thank you all for listening. Again, patreon.com/linoleumknife. Come check out our extra content and fabulous prizes. We will pay taxes on them.
oh, we just did.
And if you just want a t-shirt,
between pay the sales tax and the car being fixed, it's peanut butter and jelly sandwiches until Easter. Oh, but the Easter dinner is going to be so good.
Well, more on that later.
Oh, God.
Anyway.
Guys, I'm making a cassoulet.
It's very exciting.
It's really exciting.
If you want an a la carte t-shirt, again, email us at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com.
Ask us. Don't pay for it yet. Ask us what sizes we have left, please.
Find out. Ask about sizes.
$22 when we sort out whether or not we have the one you want.
And let us know if you're outside of the U.S. Yeah. or not. Golly. And if you are in the Los Angeles area this Wednesday night, March 28th, I'm going to be at the Arrow doing a Q&A with two, I believe, Academy Award winning screenwriters, Ron Nieswander, who wrote Philadelphia.
You believe they're going to be there, or you believe they won Academy Awards?
They're definitely going to be there.
Okay.
Ron Nieswander, who wrote Philadelphia, and Diana Ossana, who co-wrote Brokeback Mountain with Larry McMurtry. There's a double feature of those two movies. I'm doing an interview with the two writers in between, sponsored by Writers Guild of America West. Should be an interesting evening. Come check that out, please. That would be a lot of fun. In the meantime, if you've not subscribed to my other podcast, Who Shot Ya, please do. Max Fun Drive is coming up. I'll have more about that pretty soon. And check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Listen to Canceled Too Soon and Critically Acclaimed with Bibbs and Whitney and The Schmoes Know. Anyone with Dennis Hensley. The Comics Canon, All Things Cozy, The Sewers of Paris, Super Gay, Criterion Cast, Fat Guys at the Movies, Film Spotting, SVU, and Secretly Timid. You can follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Subscribe to the show for free at Apple Podcasts and leave us a positive review there. We love getting those 5-star reviews and we'll read it on the show. It helps people find the program.
5 stars is the only one I'll be reading on this show.
That's right.
Don't you bring me no 4s.
You can also period. You can also leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio and TheLounge.com, Spotify, and Google Play, and CastBox, and Podbean, and Podable, and all the places where you get your podcasts. You can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. And yeah, it's been a blast. We'll catch you next time. So until then.
Goodbye.